After you've squinted into the sky to make out that box where the falcon lives, bring your eyes back down to Earth. Maybe you'll see a tall man with a white beard and a camera. His name is Chris Ducharme.
Hi, Chris.
Oh, hello.
I found Chris on Friday doing what he does every day lately, checking up on the bird.
See anything today?
Yeah, actually, she just came out of her nest box, flew around once, landed close by, and then jumped back in.
He's in his 60s, he's retired, and spends a lot of his time photographing birds. It was after going through years of photos he realized this one falcon never leaves Austin in the summer.
So it made this sense, wow, we've got a resident bird, and would see it in the summer when you're not supposed to be seeing other birds.
He calls her the Tower Girl.
She lives at the tower, it's a girl. And that's what we, amongst a group of us, sort of refer to her as the Tower Girl.
Right now is a special time of year for the Tower Girl. About 6 weeks ago, she started laying eggs. As we talk, she's up there sitting on them.
And what I'm hoping to see is her return to the box with food. If there's youngsters in there and they've popped out or starting to, she will be taking them food.
The same thing happened last year, and the eggs never hatched. Being the only permanent resident, the Tower Girl doesn't have a mate, so it's likely these eggs are not fertilized either. But male peregrines do winter in Austin, so it's possible. The thing is, the clock is ticking. If nothing happens after 6 weeks, odds are these eggs are never going to hatch.
Yes, we've basically given it through this weekend, and that's even allowing for time that we miscalculated.
It's human nature to root for them.
Yeah, it is. I think there's this side of, you know, what does she feel? I have a clue about these creatures. It's just sort of been, I got to say, some days it's just like, wow, this is just sort of difficult to watch.
But we do. While we sit staring at the tower, Chris talks about the life cycle and range of falcons.
The Texas thing is interesting. It's a huge flyway. Lots of birds come through, but they don't really live here.
How peregrine falcons were almost completely wiped out.
The DDT was the issue, you know, the shells. The shells just weren't thick enough.
And how he became interested in photographing birds. He says it started with his wife.
We were just birders. We liked to watch. I would send her email photos that I'd taken so she could look at them at different times. And I would call them photos or snaps or pics, anything but photographs. And finally one day she said, Chris, you are a photographer. You take photographs. End of discussion. She's really is my inspiration for doing this. She's died in 2012, and something that I basically do this every day, and she's the reason why.
Every time I take a picture, it's sort of like I'm thinking of her. It really is.
While we wait, we also attract attention.
Hi.
A group of school kids wave as they walk by us. A sharply dressed guy in from out of town comes and asks us what we're looking at. And a university employee named Phil Butler joins Chris on his lunch break.
So what do you think? What do you think about the eggs this year?
I mean, you know, we can hope that they hatch. We can hope that it's there and that it's going to be a thing. But I also know that she faces a lot of challenges trying to do it by herself.
There's a little excitement when two vultures make for the tower, but nothing comes of it. Most of our time is spent just staring, almost in a state of self-hypnosis, like this.
Wow. Yeah, I just started going into the zone here.
Yeah, you do. That's pretty much it.
Then, suddenly,
there she goes. There she goes. Look at her.
She springs from the box, cutting circles in the air near the tower, designed so perfectly for speed, she's not flying so much as shooting through the sky.
You see here?
She's gorgeous.
She doesn't fly much, so this is a treat for you.
We watch for a sign that she's seeking prey, any indication that the eggs have hatched. But she returns to the box quickly, talons empty, and disappears inside.
Today and tomorrow, it'll be apparent. Either it's happening or it's not.
I tell Chris I'll call him to see how it worked out. And yesterday, I did.
Hello.
Hey, Chris, it's Mose calling.
Hey, Mose, how you doing?
I was just curious if there'd been any updates about the Tower Girl.
I arrived yesterday, still sort of, okay, it's past the day, but I'm okay. I think I'm being hopeful.
But he says there was no sign of activity.
There's certainly no evidence that the chicks have hatched.
And odds are they won't.
She has no mate. It's just, you know, it's just the sad part of the story for this lone bird is it just doesn't, you know, all the pieces don't come together for her.
He says if things go like they did last year, the falcon will start spending less and less time on the nest. Letting go, he calls it. But Chris says he'll keep me updated. He plans to keep visiting and taking pictures. At least one loyal companion for the Tower Girl. Mose Bushel, KET News. This is a story about two guys and how a neighborhood shaped their lives.
Testing. This is the first time I've ever used this mic, so you gotta forgive me.
It's all right. Get it together.
This is Andreas Mueller.
I can honestly say this is the first time I've ever been recorded.
Oh, yeah? Okay.
Openly recorded.
And this is Matthew Malcolm Kleinman.
I'm born in Brackenridge Hospital in 1979.
They grew up together on the East Side. Tell me a little bit about your family.
Both my parents are radical activists, hippies.
And my mother knew his mother from going to UT from the 70s.
So what's a good soundtrack for their childhood?
I'm told by my parents the first record I ever heard was Jimi Hendrix Experience.
This is how they remember it.
Man, we would just little kids run around the neighborhood. If we seen a trampoline in your backyard, we would come knock on your door, ask you, can we jump on the trampoline?
It was a family atmosphere. Old people used to sit on their porches and watch us and yelling at us, you know, while we were running through their yards. Get off my grass.
There were hard parts, too. Money was tight. Andreas' mom was sick with lupus. He started caring for her, even driving her around when he was just a kid. Matthew's parents often weren't around, so they say the neighborhood helped raise them. This is how Matt describes the East Side back in the 80s.
We were not poor. We were working class people. We were proud working class people. We were people that had everything in our communities and our neighborhoods that we needed. We had mom and pop grocery stores, Roy Lee's on Manor Road, okay? Guess what? Black owned, mom and pop. They were all over the East Side. You know, we never felt welcome on West Austin, which is why we didn't go there. But we were always at home on the East Side.
I think a lot of people that listen to whatever story comes out of this will probably imagine that you're a black guy.
Maybe.
Here I'm talking to Matt.
A lot of people have thought that my entire life, though, especially just hearing my voice.
It wasn't Matt, that's White Boy Matt.
That's my name.
White Boy Matt.
Yeah.
My oldest son, whenever he was about 2 or 3, called him White Boy Matt. We all snapped on him. You don't get to call him White Boy Matt. You only call him Matt, or Uncle Matt.
But I think at that time, that's something that brought us together, too. Yeah. I have to say, like, you know, both of us, for different reasons, weren't really even accepted in our own communities.
Matthew, because he was a white guy who identified with black culture. Andreas, because he was mixed race. His dad is African American. His mom, a white East German immigrant.
Came over here by herself and was never married and ended up having, you know, a mixed child and, you know, an immigrant with a minority child, you know, growing up in Texas, you know, was something different. That might have been one of our early bonding points.
Outcasts.
Not ever knowing it.
And a lot of our other friends were outcasts in different ways, too, you know.
Things got harder, as they usually do, when the guys became teenagers. But it was more than just the usual challenges. Andreas' mom got sicker. Matt's parents divorced. This was in the early 90s, and they say the neighborhood was changing, too.
Gangs and violence kind of started to have this place in East Austin, and it came into my life.
Now here, they want to be careful. On one hand, they feel like the East Side got a bad rap when it came to crime.
Don't let it be said that, you know, we were like the normal.
The whole East Side
sound
like, no, because it was families over there.
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't
people trying to
crack houses on every block.
Yeah.
It was families over there.
But on the other hand, they say drug dealing became part of their reality.
What's this?
This is Criminal Element, man. This is
Texas music, Houston.
Yeah, Texas music. But I mean, a lot of this music we used to listen to reflected of what we were in our environment was. You know, you relate to what you see, what you live.
So here's what they saw. Crack hits the street in the 80s. Police, who seem to turn a blind eye to drug use in white communities, start focusing on drug enforcement on the east side.
You know, there's lawyers that live on the west side that snort up tons of cocaine, you know what I mean?
They think some of that law enforcement created more chaos than it prevented. Older men were incarcerated. Boys like Matthew and Andreas started taking their place.
That was the best thing you could give me, knowing that my mom's finna die.
Jason Dubinsky lives on the north side of Lake Austin.
As the crow flies, where I work is actually really close.
There's just one problem. Work is across the water in Westlake. And with traffic, his car commute was 2 hours every day. It really got to him.
A long time I was thinking about how I could overcome that, considered swimming, but the lake kind of smells.
So, 6 months ago, he bought this. An inflatable kayak.
You must have this kind of down to a science now.
Yeah, it took me a while the first few times, but started getting a little bit quicker at it.
2 days a week, he heads off to work from Woodland Park on the North Shore at 7:30 in the morning, when there's hardly anyone around.
There's a certain amount of peacefulness in the morning when the water is just still, like glass, and you can hear the birds.
He rows to the other side in about 10 minutes, deflates the kayak, and stuffs it in his backpack.
That's really the best part, is on the water. Now it's going to be the tough part. We've got about 3 mile hike uphill.
You're killing me here, man.
There are no sidewalks, so we stick to the shoulders of the roads, passing well-tended lawns, the occasional dog, a few people who wave or stare quizzically, maybe thinking, who's this guy going by in a wide-brimmed hat, backpack, and knee-high black compression socks?
It's funny, too, because I've never really been a very popular person. You know, I'll post something on Facebook and maybe I'll get 9 or 10 likes. But whenever I post about my commute, it like really spikes, 40, 50 people. And I think there's like something universal about our hatred of traffic.
Since he started, Dubinsky says he's gotten in better shape and become more relaxed. Sometimes he puts on headphones, listens to Bob Dylan or Neil Young while he hikes.
Are there any Dylan songs or Neil Young songs that if we were going to use for this story that would resonate the most?
Maybe Heart of Gold? Because it's about searching, and I think ultimately that's what this commute is for me, searching for find peace.
Now, before you go out and buy your own kayak, there are a few things to consider. For one, Jason has a job that lets him wash and change clothes when he gets there. Also, he hasn't tried this in the summer yet.
Summer's gonna be tricky.
Maybe I'll call you in a couple months and find out how it's going.
That's fair.
We keep walking and walking, up, up, up. The houses get fancier with elevation. A guy named John Smiley calls out, asking what we're doing.
Training for a trip or something? Or?
It's just how I get to work.
Oh, okay.
Have you seen him go by before?
Yeah, seen him walking around, yeah.
Have you looked at him and wondered what's going on?
Yeah, we wondered. We thought he was maybe training to do the Appalachian Trail or something, but.
And we keep walking.
All right, we've been walking for, it feels like maybe at least 40 minutes now, and I've got to say this is no joke. This is a true workout. I've sweat through my t-shirt, and Jason's doing this with a backpack on.
Eventually, the sound of fast-moving cars becomes audible. We're nearing the road that Dubinsky would be taking if he were driving.
And so at the very end, we hit the traffic that you've been avoiding this whole time.
Yeah.
We race across the street and into the parking lot. It's an hour and a half after we started.
You can finally start your day.
Yeah.
Do you ever feel like, wow, I just did all that, and now I go to work?
I always find I have a pep in my step these days when I'm doing the kite commute.
He says some of his coworkers think he's crazy for getting to work this way. But for him, it's no crazier than sitting in a car for 2 hours a day. Mose Bouchel, KET News.